Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now! The UN Security Council votes nearly unanimously to lift the sanctions on Iraq. The vote also gives the U.S. the legal authority to occupy Iraq and to control billions of dollars worth of Iraqi oil. And was the invasion of Iraq the deadliest U.S. military campaign for civilians since Vietnam? We'll go to Baghdad to speak with a Christian Science Monitor reporter who estimates 10,000 civilians may have died. For every U.S. soldier who died, 33 Iraqi civilians died. And how does media consolidation affect children? A new study has found that the centralization of media has led to a dramatic decrease in children's programming. The FCC poised to unleash the largest wave of media consolidation yet. All that and more coming up. The Bush administration is coming under increasing criticism from the Senate over its handling of the reconstruction of Iraq. You are listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At a hearing of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Republican Chair Richard Lugar warned President Bush the United States is on the brink of a catastrophe in Iraq. Lugar said Iraq could become a, quote, incubator for terrorist cells and activity because U.S. reconstruction efforts have failed so far. Lugar went on to say the planning for peace was much less developed than the planning for war. At the same hearing, Democrat Joseph Biden of Delaware berated the Bush administration. Biden asked, when is the president going to tell the American people we're likely to be in a country of Iraq for 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 10 years with thousands of forces and spending billions of dollars? Because it's not been told to them yet. Biden went on to say, I don't know about you, but my home constituency doesn't understand that. They think Johnny and Jane are going to come marching home pretty soon. The United Nations Security Council voted nearly unanimously yesterday to lift the sanctions on Iraq and to give the U.S. the legal authority to occupy Iraq and to control its oil. The Security Council vote was 14-0. Syria, the only Arab nation on the council, boycotted the vote. The vote was criticized by some. International law expert Francis Boyle said Bush is basically getting the Security Council to reverse the long-standing Stimson doctrine that the world will not recognize the fruits of an aggressive war. But that is exactly what the Security Council has just done, he said. We'll have more on that story in a few minutes. The U.S. overseer of Iraq, Paul Bremer, announced yesterday Iraq's old security apparatus has been abolished. The Republican Guard has been disbanded. The defense ministry closed down, the military and security courts dissolved, he said. The U.S. said a new armed force will be formed to replace the Iraqi army. The BBC reports the announcement is a highly symbolic act designed to try to convince Iraqis that the United States is taking steps toward reconstruction. Separatists in the Indonesian province of Aceh have accused the military of forcibly relocating hundreds of families as part of their new offensive to crush rebels, this according to The Guardian of London. Reuters is also reporting more than 23,000 people have fled their homes and are now refugees. The attack of Aceh is Indonesia's largest military operation in a quarter of a century. The White House has reached a tentative agreement with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to endorse for the first time the Bush administration's so-called roadmap to peace, this according to the New York Times. The peace plan calls for a series of reciprocal steps leading to the establishment of a Palestinian state and a secure and peaceful environment for Israel. The Palestinians endorsed the plan, but Israel has so far balked. Administration officials said part of the plan has been rewritten to address concerns of Israel. Israel is demanding a ban on the return to Israel of Palestinian refugees living outside the country. It also wants to leave the issue of dismantling Jewish settlements in the West Bank and Gaza Strip to the distant future. The revised text has yet to be released. Tommy Franks, the general who led U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, has announced he will retire this summer. Franks was in the news earlier this month when he was charged with war crimes in a Belgian court related to use of U.S. cluster bombs in Iraq, as well as incidents where U.S. troops are accused of firing on ambulances and civilians. The Pentagon is moving forward in establishing military tribunals to try prisoners detained in the so-called War on Terror. Yesterday, the Pentagon named a chief prosecutor and defense counsel to oversee the tribunals. The World Health Organization has lifted its travel warning to Hong Kong and China's southern Guangdong province, saying the SARS virus is now under control there. The SARS virus has killed more than 600 people worldwide and infected more than 7,800 people, mostly in Asia. There is still no known cure. The New York Times is reporting the drug company Bayer knowingly sold blood-clotting agents infected with HIV to Asian and Latin American countries for a year after it introduced a safer alternative in U.S. and European markets. The blood-clotting agent was commonly used by hemophiliacs in the early 1980s and became one of the leading causes of HIV for hemophiliacs. The death toll in Algeria from the country's worst earthquake in two decades has topped more than 1,000. Over 5,000 people have been left injured or homeless. In the early hours of today, the U.S. House voted 231 to 200 to pass a $350 billion tax cut at the urging of President Bush. The bill now goes to the Senate, which is expected to approve it later this morning. Democrat Gene Taylor of Mississippi was among those voting no. He said they're taking money from working people, Social Security taxes, Medicare taxes. They're using it to give to other folks in tax breaks. Then they're borrowing the rest to run our nation. This is the theft of the future of America. Listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations Security Council voted nearly unanimously yesterday to lift the sanctions on Iraq and to give the U.S. the legal authority to occupy Iraq and control its oil. The Security Council vote was 14-0. Syria, the only Arab nation, boycotted the vote. The resolution ends over a decade of devastating economic sanctions on Iraq. The sanctions were imposed after Iraq invaded Kuwait. According to the United Nations' own calculations, the sanctions are responsible for the deaths of between 500,000 and 1 million Iraqi children. The resolution also gives the U.S. administration an international legal mandate to rule Iraq until a viable Iraqi government is established. And it gives U.S. occupation forces the authority to export Iraq's oil. According to the London Guardian, expanded oil exports could bring over $20 billion a year. Some $13 billion is expected to go towards reconstruction. We're joined right now by Joy Gordon, professor of philosophy and international human rights at Fairfield University in Connecticut, and author of Cold War, Economic Sanctions as a Weapon of Mass Destruction, for Harper's Magazine. She's working on her first book, A Peaceful, Silent, Deadly Remedy. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you start off by analyzing the vote that took place yesterday? Nearly unanimous, Syria didn't vote.
Well, we don't know, or at least we don't know yet, what kinds of deals were made behind the scenes, such that France and Russia in particular caved in. But certainly the implications of this vote are just breathtaking. If we I'm generally opposed to sanctions in general. Sanctions virtually always do harm to the innocent. They virtually always have no impact on those who you're trying to influence, and so on. In this particular case, though, the Oil for Food program was a program that provided transparency, focus, tremendous legitimacy and accountability, and the gist of this vote. The implication is certainly that there will be no transparency to speak of. There will be no accountability. There will be no way of restraining what may turn out to just be opening the door to the candy store for U.S. companies.
Mm. Can you talk about the Oil for Food program and what it has been, what it has meant?
Yeah, the Oil for Food program, it started out as something that was intended to be an interim program. It turned out to be much more elaborate than that. What it did have was a very thorough system to make sure that the money was handled properly, to make sure that the right goods were purchased, to make sure that the goods got to the people that they needed to get to. So Iraq submitted a distribution plan every 6 months to the Secretary General's office that said, here are the goods we plan to buy with this money. The Secretary General's office then reviewed those to make sure that the goods intended to be purchased were consistent with the most urgent humanitarian priorities. Oil sales, SOMO, the Iraqi government oil entity, in conjunction with something called the oil overseers, would each month present the proposed price based on the market to the 661 committee, the committee of the Security Council that oversaw the sanctions, so that before for each period of oil sales, there was a point of scrutiny. Is this a price that is concealing kickbacks? If so, then they wouldn't approve that. UN humanitarian agencies had a significant role in this, in order to determine whether or not the goods were that Iraq was purchasing goods and consistent with humanitarian needs. The Oil for Food program drew on the enormous expertise and experience of the people from UNICEF and World Food Program and Food and Agriculture, all of whom had people on the ground in Iraq, all of whom were in a position to say, yes, this is what's most needed. And then finally, the Oil for Food program was mandated and did monitor not only the purchase of goods, but then the distribution, to make sure that the entire system was consistent with the principles of equity, efficiency, and adequacy within the financial constraints available. So now we have nothing like that. There is no entity involved. The 661 committee under this new resolution is disbanded in a few months. We have absolutely no entity whose job is to make sure that goods are distributed equitably, that goods are distributed efficiently, that those who are most urgently in need of them get them.
Can you talk about the Iraq medical team there and what is happening now with money for health in Iraq?
Well, the reports that I've seen suggest a terrible kind of chaos that, you know, Iraq had an excellent public health system prior to the first Persian Gulf War. I think it was something like half of their doctors were trained in Europe and the U.S., and half of those in turn were board certified under U.S. and European standards. They have no shortage of highly skilled people, particularly in the health sector. What they're desperate for is equipment and medical supplies. And I'm sure your listeners, as well as I, have been hearing the stories of an emergency room that consists of nothing but, you know, six mattresses or something like that, no analgesics, literally the inability to provide anesthetic during surgery. If we're interested in rebuilding Iraq's health system, they clearly have the expertise because they've been running a surprisingly good system under terrible circumstances for a decade, and an excellent system prior to that. Instead, what we see is, well, one contract that's gone out so far, again, without competitive bidding, like the other contracts that the U.S. has signed already, to the Apt consulting company out of Cambridge, Mass., for $48 million. And you have to ask yourself, is this the first sign of what it means to rebuild Iraq, that a nearly $50 million contract goes not to Iraqi health specialists who know how to run their system and to buy $50 million worth of medical equipment, but to a consulting contract with a U.S. company?
We're talking to Joy Gordon, who is a professor of international human rights law at the University of Fairfield in Connecticut. Whatever concessions, what are the concessions that the U.S. Made to the U.N. or to other countries in this vote? It's being cast in different ways. The New York Times talking about this vote in the U.N. Security Council winning an international mandate to occupy and rebuild Iraq for Britain and the United States. And The Guardian talking about oil from post-war Iraq now expected to start flowing. The Security Council decision seeing Russia, France, Germany, and China swallow their misgivings to legitimize the outcome of a war they strenuously opposed.
Well, it looks to me like the concessions, in fact, were not very significant. It may just be that the other actors in the Security Council did not want another bruising encounter with the U.S., but the concessions are not great. Under the original sanctions regime, the 661 resolution imposed sanctions that were open-ended, so that in order to end the sanctions ever, it would have taken another Security Council resolution. That meant that the U.S. held what came to be called a reverse veto, which is that however awful the regime became, the U.S. could unilaterally ensure that it continued indefinitely. And we see the same structure reproduced here, which is that rather than say, here is a system of occupation, and we'll run it for a year, and then at the end of the year it will expire, we will look to see if in fact, you know, the Iraqi people are benefiting from this, if in fact we're making good political progress and it's not necessary anymore. And instead of anything like that, there's only a 12-month review. There's literally just a report to the Security Council to discuss further steps for implementation. So we have once again an open-ended system over which the U.S. will have this reverse veto, which can continue indefinitely for as long as the U.S. wishes to keep it in place. Because obviously anyone in the Security Council who wants to introduce a resolution to end it at any point in the future, that resolution would be subject to U.S. veto. There were not many concessions, as far as I can see, even with regard to the economic interests of, again, particularly France and Russia. There's currently, under the most recent draft of the resolution, prior to this, the only oil for food contracts currently signed that would have been approved were ones relating to food and nutrition. And under this, the Secretary General may review existing oil for food contracts to decide whether or not to grant them or enforce them concerning all existing oil for food contracts. So that means that the contracts that France and Russia and other countries have may get paid. And under the resolution draft prior to this, they would certainly not have gotten paid. So again, that doesn't look to me like a great concession. And again, that's just for existing contracts. And then that will be over as soon as those contracts are finished, one way or the other.
Hmm. Can you explain more, Joy Gordon, the 661 committee?
Yeah, the 661 committee is a committee established under Resolution 661, which is the one that created the sanctions regime. It's a committee that had two odd functions, or odd in conjunction with each other. One was to enforce the sanctions regime, and the other was to grant humanitarian exemptions to it. The overall result was, as you might expect, a fundamental tension between the security interests and the humanitarian interests. And the way the committee ended up resolving that tension at nearly every juncture was in favor of security over humanitarian interests. So for any item, let's say child vaccines, if it was at all conceivable that these child vaccines could, under the most speculative scenario, be turned into biological weapons, then the committee, and actually at this point I should switch and just start referring to the U.S. alone, would say, this presents a security interest, we hereby block these goods. And the other, the humanitarian interest that would be competing, which is, well, you have a country with skyrocketing child mortality. Obviously, $200 million of child vaccines is crucial just to the matter of survival. And that interest invariably got trumped by security interests, however speculative. The 661 committee ended up being entirely dominated by the U.S. because of the veto structure. Any country had the power to veto any contract for any reason or for no reason. Late in the sanctions regime, some sets of non-controversial goods bypassed that committee and so were exempted from that. But throughout the history of the committee, what you saw again and again and again is the U.S. Sometimes joined with Britain, but predominantly not. Predominantly it was the U.S. acting unilaterally, blocking the most tremendous array of basic goods. As of last summer, the U.S. had $5 billion of critical humanitarian goods blocked. The U.S. blocked everything from child vaccines to trucks for food distribution to yogurt-making equipment. Between the ceilings on the oil sales and U.S. blocks of humanitarian goods, the total that was delivered from the beginning of the oil food program and for food program in late '96 up to this January came to $180 per person per year. That's one half the per capita income of Haiti.
Well, Joy Gordon, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Professor of Philosophy, International Human Rights Law at Fairfield University in Connecticut. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. While the world's attention is focused on the lifting of UN sanctions in Iraq, we now turn to another story from Iraq that has received practically no attention. The Christian Science Monitor is reporting the evidence is mounting that suggests between 5 and 10,000 Iraqi civilians died during the U.S. invasion. The Monitor reports this would make the Iraq War the deadliest campaign for noncombatants that U.S. forces have fought since Vietnam. The estimate is based on data provided by researchers involved in independent surveys of Iraq. It's extremely difficult to obtain casualty figures for either Iraqi civilians or soldiers. As General Tommy Franks said during the Afghanistan invasion, we don't do body counts. The Monitor's estimates are higher than any previously reported. The website IraqBodyCount.net has estimated the number of Iraqi civilians killed to be between 4,800 and 6,500. By another measure of violence against civilians, the invasion of Iraq was particularly brutal. In the 1989 U.S. invasion of Panama, 13 Panamanian civilians died for every U.S. military fatality. If 5,000 Iraqi civilians died in the latest invasion, the proportion would be 33 to 1. We're joined now by Peter Ford, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, reporting from Baghdad. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
Can you tell us how you have gone about collating the figures, arriving at the number that you have of Iraqi civilians who've died during the U.S. invasion?
Yes, well, some of the work has been my own, but I was doing that basically at hospitals and morgues to try and get a sense, just from one small part of Baghdad, of what might have happened. But the figures are coming from, as I say, independent researchers who have got teams all over the country collecting reports from hospitals, from mosques, from morgues, from ordinary homes, from places where people saw civilians being buried just on the side of the street. And there are a number of such teams. None of them will, at the moment, go on the record with their figures because this is early days and they're not sure enough of the final count to be able to publicly announce it. But they say that their initial reports, their initial surveys, are pointing towards figures that might go as high as I said, between 5 and 10,000.
Tell us where you went in Iraq and how many people are involved in counting right now.
Well, as I say, a number of different organizations are all over the country. They're down in the Four Peninsula in the south where the war began, in Basra, and then they are following the way that the American troops went as they came towards Baghdad, which was basically, there were a number of thrusts, but the two major thrusts were up the Tigris Valley and up the Euphrates Valley. The Tigris Valley was taken by the 3rd Infantry Division mainly, and the Euphrates was the route that the Marines took towards Baghdad. That would appear to be where most of the civilian casualties occurred, in the towns and villages up those two valleys, both from ground fighting as the forces themselves advanced and met resistance from Fedayeen and from the air, from bombs and missiles that were dropped and strafing by A-10 Warthogs, anti-armor machine guns mounted on American A-10s. It's hard to say at the moment exactly which part of the war caused more of the damage. There are certain organizations such as Human Rights Watch, which is concentrating on the way in which civilian casualties were inflicted, and they're particularly concerned by the very wide use of cluster bombs. They let out thousands of tiny bomblets, and when they explode, they send out shards of steel over an area that covers about the size of a football field, killing and wounding anything in it. They're normally used against mass infantry in open spaces, and if you do use them in areas where civilians live, and there's a lot of evidence that they were used in civilian areas, I myself have found unexploded bomblets in parts of Baghdad, then they're obviously lethal for civilians.
Cluster bombs. When you talk about bomblets.
Yes. These are cluster bombs, yes, which are legal weapons. They are allowed under the laws of war. Nobody has banned cluster bombs in the way that landmines have been banned. But a lot depends on the way they're used, because indiscriminate weapons are banned by the laws of war. And some organizations, such as Human Rights Watch, make the argument that when you use them in civilian areas, they tend to become indiscriminate. Partly, of course, because as many as 10-15% of the bomblets do not explode on impact. They are left lying around. They're curious little inch-long cylinders, some of them with ribbons attached, which attract children. Can't always be seen if they're lying in the grass of a verge, for example, and kill civilians or wound civilians long after conflicts are over, unless they're cleared up. Now, the Americans are doing what they can to clear the bomblets that they find up in Baghdad. I was in a district in southern Baghdad where there were scores and scores of these unexploded bomblets all over the place, some of them hanging from lemon trees by their ribbons. And the Americans were destroying them, blowing them up, getting everybody out of the area. They weren't doing any damage blown up like that. But clearly, where those are found after the war, they can cause continued civilian injuries even when the combat is over.
We're speaking to Peter Ford, Christian Science Monitor reporter in Baghdad, as he tries to tally up the casualty count in Iraq. You quote Ali Ismail, a Red Crescent official, saying in Baghdad, we've discovered 1,000 graves, and that is not the final figure. Every day we discover more.
Well, this is part of the problem of reaching any definitive or accurate figure on civilian casualties, because obviously a lot of people were taken to hospital either injured or already dead, because hospitals were authorized to issue death certificates during the war. You didn't have to go to the city morgue. But sometimes, and it's hard to tell exactly how often, people simply didn't bother to go to the hospital. It was too dangerous. They didn't want to go out. They were afraid, or they didn't know who the person lying dead in the street was. And they buried them there and then. And there are a number of places in Baghdad, and I'm sure in other cities, where people were buried in common graves or two or three at a time, by the side of the road, in the gardens of mosques, in the gardens of hospitals, just or simply where bodies were found. And that is going to take a long time to count up, because it really takes people going door to door, going round places where bombing or fighting is known to have taken place, and said, you know, and asking them, do you know where civilians are buried? Have you seen anybody buried around here? Did you see anybody being buried? Did you yourself bury anyone? And this is the sort of process that will take weeks, if not months.
Peter Ford, what about the U.S. military response to the casualty figures in Iraq?
Well, they haven't, as you said, General Tommy Frank said, we don't do body counts. The American Army is not in the business of counting civilian casualties. They're not going to count civilian casualties. But under congressional legislation, both concerning Iraq and concerning Afghanistan, the United States government is meant to be putting money towards assisting the civilian victims of war, whether they lost their homes or lost their breadwinner or were injured. This hasn't yet happened in Afghanistan. The money's been set aside, $2.5 million, I think. It hasn't yet been spent because USAID, which is meant to be doing it, says that the areas where they ought to be spending the money are too insecure still in Afghanistan. We'll have to see how that goes in Iraq. But the Department of Defense, the Army itself, says that that's not their concern. And a number of humanitarian organizations as well say that they are less concerned with counting the dead than with coping with the living and dealing with their problems after the war. The International Committee of the Red Cross, for example, ICRC, based in Geneva, began to start counting from hospital records, decided the hospital records were too partial, too unlikely to be accurate to make it really worthwhile devoting a lot of time and energy to counting them when there were a lot of people after the war who need immediate assistance because they're still alive.
Well, Peter Ford, I want to thank you for doing this count, gathering information about it, and the researchers that are on the ground, the different organizations that you're getting this information from. Are there other newspapers in terms of press coverage that are equally concerned?
Well, I think there are a number of journalists who are interested in the subject, and they are They're investigating, talking to people, doing their own counts, in fact. But it's the sort of thing that takes an awful lot of resources, takes a lot of time, and I think probably most newspapers will leave it to the organizations concerned and report their figures as and when they come out. The Los Angeles Times, for example, though, did devote a long story quite recently to work they'd done counting figures from hospital records in, I think, 27 hospitals in and around Baghdad. They reached a figure of 1,700 civilians having died in the battle for Baghdad, the 3 or 4 days leading up to the 9th of April when that statue was pulled down. But that's just Baghdad, and it's just from hospital records. So I think there's a reasonable chance that the figure is, in fact, higher than that, although how much higher one can't tell. And that was simply the capital. There was, obviously, a lot of damage in Baghdad. There was a lot of bombing, which could well have caused a lot of civilian casualties. But that's only one place, even though it's the largest place in Iraq. I think that the towns up the river valleys leading to Baghdad also suffered considerably, both from air and from the ground. And those are the places where counts are still going on.
So finally, Peter Ford, the figure that you have arrived at this point.
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
The figure that you are working with, the number that you're working with at this point, in summary.
Well, I think as a very preliminary estimate, one can reliably, or at least reasonably reliably, suggest a range of between 5,000 and 10,000 civilian fatalities during the war.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Peter Ford, reporting from Baghdad for the Christian Science Monitor. And you are listening to Democracy Now. Thank you. As we turn now to another issue, on Wednesday, President Bush charged European nations are perpetuating starvation in Africa by subsidizing agricultural exports and objecting to the use of genetically engineered crops. Bush claimed that U.S. efforts to reduce hunger in Africa have been thwarted by European policies. This is the latest attack from the White House on countries that oppose genetically engineered foods. The U.S. Has filed a complaint with the World Trade Organization against nations that have barred genetically engineered food. And now Bush has signed an AIDS bill that suggests the U.S. will withhold giving AIDS medications to African nations if they refuse to accept genetically engineered food aid. In response to the AIDS bill, Greenpeace has launched a campaign against the Senate Majority Leader, Dr. Bill Frist. Earlier this week, Greenpeace filed a complaint with the state of Tennessee calling for an ethics investigation of Frist. The group says Frist has backed a bill that attempts to coerce African nations into accepting food by suggesting it could be tied to receipt of AIDS prevention funding. Greenpeace says such action flies in the face of a physician's duty to protect and foster free, uncoerced choices. We're joined now by Charles Margulis of the Greenpeace Genetic Engineering Project. He is a genetic engineering specialist at Greenpeace. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy.
Well, can you tell us more about this? Let's start with the Frist story, the doctor in the House, or should I say the Senate?
Yes. Dr. Frist bills himself as the Senate's only doctor, and his campaigning and political machinations are dripping with his medical expertise and background. So when he sponsored this AIDS bill, which contains a provision suggesting that African countries may lose their AIDS prevention money if they continue to refuse genetically engineered crops, we term that as medical blackmail, and decided that a medical ethics investigation should be pursued. We went to the state of Tennessee because that's where Frist is licensed as a doctor. That's his home state. And we expect that the state will look into this investigation thoroughly, and that we hope that other ethics breaches of Frist's career come out in the investigation as well.
Can you explain exactly what the U.S. position is? They're saying if an African country will not accept genetically modified foods, they won't get AIDS drugs?
Well, the legislation is very vague on this term. It basically suggests that African countries that are refusing food aid from the U.S. because it's genetically engineered should start accepting it, because, of course, AIDS patients need adequate nutrition. It's a veiled threat. The legislation doesn't come out precisely and hold this over Africans' head. But in international negotiations, this is the way these things work. African countries, this is a warning shot across the bow of these African countries, saying to them, we've just filed a case against the European Union, and you may be next. And if we file this case, we're going to point to this legislation. We're going to say, we warned you. This was in this legislation. You knew that this was something that we were concerned about, and you're going to have to bow to the U.S. government and its desire to force-feed these genetically engineered crops to the rest of the world. So really, what this provision in this bill suggests is that the Africans will be held to this down the line.
Do you know what African countries in particular would be affected by this, and have any been vocal on the issue of genetically engineered foods?
Well, southern African countries that are facing a famine and starvation have been increasingly vocal since last summer about this. In particular, Zambia has refused genetically engineered food aid. Several countries initially refused the food aid, but later agreed to terms where genetically engineered food would be milled before it was sent to African countries. That would eliminate some of the environmental issues around the potential for these crops to actually grow in African countries. Once you mill the grain, then it won't be viable anymore. But even with milling, Zambia was still uncertain about accepting the aid because of the potential health effects of genetically engineered grain, which haven't been studied in the long term. And this is the real paternalistic view of the Bush administration towards Africa, that these African countries aren't smart enough to think of this on their own. They're simply following Europe's line. It's just not the case. In 1999, African scientists from nearly 24 African countries signed a statement that said these genetically engineered crops are neither safe, environmentally friendly, nor beneficial to us. And they rejected genetic engineering and looked at the alternative production, native agricultural systems that have been feeding their citizens for generations before first world paternalism came in and disrupted their native economies and their native agriculture. So really, the idea that Africa needs this genetically engineered food is just a total turnaround of the real kind of agricultural policies that we need to promote to really promote food sovereignty. The U.S. and the World Food Program talks about food security, which is an important concept. But African countries and Via Campesina, the farmers movement around the world, has been talking about food sovereignty, the idea that countries have the right to determine their own kind of food production that will feed their own population in a culturally appropriate way, in the safest and most natural way available to the people in that country.
We're talking to Charles Margulis, who is Greenpeace genetic engineering specialist. On the first point, the issue of Bush charging European nations with perpetuating starvation in Africa by subsidizing agricultural exports and by objecting to the use of genetically engineered crops. Can you talk about exactly what this complaint the U.S. has filed with the World Trade Organization is? Which countries in Europe are leading the opposition to genetically engineered foods? And if you think they will succeed, or will the U.S. prevail in getting genetically engineered foods out there?
Yeah, the U.S. has no chance of winning this WTO complaint. And that's actually why it's, if you read even the conservative press, there's a lot of jitters that this is the wrong move for the administration, and the reason I say this, and like I said, even the conservatives understand this argument. If the U.S. takes Europe, the U.S. taking Europe to the WTO on this issue is a no-win proposition. Even if they win in the WTO, European consumers, and it's all across Europe. I mean, the resistance to genetic engineering is strong all across Europe. It started primarily in Austria, Germany, Norway, Switzerland, but the UK, France, Italy, Spain, virtually every country in Europe consumers have roundly rejected genetically engineered food. And even if the U.S. Wins a WTO case, that consumer sentiment isn't going to change, and food companies aren't simply going to start trying to sell food that people won't buy. In fact, the U.S. case against Europe is only going to harden resistance. So if the U.S. wins, they lose, and if they lose, they lose. This is in many folks that I've talked to who campaign on this issue in Europe, they're delighted that the U.S. has brought this campaign because it just gives more campaigning opportunities to bring to light exactly what this genetic engineering industry is really all about trying to force people to eat food that they don't want, food that's not safe, food that hasn't been tested, food that is not environmentally friendly.
Well, Charles Margulis, I want to thank you for being with us. Finally, the U.S. corporations that are behind this?
Well, of course, Monsanto is the leading genetic engineering firm in the world. More than 75% of the genetically engineered crops grown in the world come from Monsanto seed. Other biotech companies involved are Novartis, DuPont, Dow, Bayer. These are all the companies bringing us these risky genetically engineered foods. If folks would like to help Greenpeace on the first complaint, we need physicians, we need folks who are medical ethicists, we need people who have expertise in aid issues to join us as witnesses on the first complaint. Folks can still do that. You can contact Greenpeace at 800-326-0959 if you fall in any of one of those categories. We'd love to have you as a witness on the complaint. And we'd also love people to contact Bill First's office, which is 202-224-3344, and let them know that you object to this provision in this AIDS bill.
Charles Margulis of Greenpeace, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. You're listening
to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to look at the effect of children's programming with media consolidation. Stay with us.
Hello.
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 There are those that would like to lift the sanctions. I am not among them.
Thank you.
You are listening to Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today we look at big media, little kids, media consolidation, and children's programming. With the FCC vote on media ownership less than 2 weeks away, a new study reveals how a rise in media consolidation has led to a dramatic increase in children's, a dramatic decrease in children's television programming. The new study is released by a children's research and action group called Children Now, based in Oakland. It concludes there's a strong link between a reduction in children's programming and concentration of ownership. The wave of further media consolidation expected after relaxing of media ownership rules does not bode well for children's programming. The FCC solicited 12 studies to assess the impact of the rules changes on the media, but none of them examined kids' programming. Well, Patty Milijid, she is the director of Children Now, of the Children and Media Program for Children Now, and oversaw the independent research projects on children in the media. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Oh, thanks for having me this morning.
Can you talk about what you have found?
Absolutely. Well, since media concentration was allowed in Los Angeles, we found that the amount of children's programming in that market has been cut in half across the board. This is both in the number of series available for children and the number of broadcast hours. And most of the declines happen at stations that are part of a duopoly, where one company owns two broadcast stations in the same media market. It's clear that our studies, the canary in the coal mine, we're concerned that if the FCC relaxes the ownership rules on June 2nd, it will have a serious impact on the availability and diversity of children's programming.
Can you talk about specific examples of what happened in Los Angeles?
Sure, absolutely. Well, we know that in 1998, there were 88 unique children's shows per week across the stations, and that declined to 47 shows in 2003. And most of the decrease was found in three of the four stations that are part of duopolies. Some of the stations that specifically dropped a lot were ones, for example, KCOP, which is an independent station, aired 14 and 21 shows geared towards children. But it was airing actually just, but after Fox's parent company, News Corp, had purchased KCOP, it was airing just four children's series. So definitely dramatic decline. And KCBS, after KCBS's parent corporation, Viacom, purchased KCAL, children's programming fell from 26 hours per week in 1998 to 3 hours per week in 2003. That was a decrease of 89%.
We're talking to Patty Miller, who is in charge of the independent research projects on children and the media, looking at media in Los Angeles and the effect of media consolidation. Can you talk about the duopoly when one company owns two stations?
Yes, absolutely. And what's really interesting about Los Angeles and why we chose to study Los Angeles is because the FCC let Los Angeles have duopolies. So they let Viacom and News Corp own two stations in that market because they claimed the market was so diverse and that having duopolies in that market wouldn't make a big difference. Well, what we found is that there's a huge difference and that, in fact, duopoly stations are airing less programming for kids. So what I think is so interesting is that if the FCC deregulates on June 2nd, we will see duopolies takes place in probably 100 markets across the country, and we think Los Angeles serves as a bellwether for what could happen with future media concentration if duopolies are allowed. We're also concerned about kids' educational programming. What happens in a market if an owner owns a couple of stations and they're airing the same educational programming for kids? You're going to see much less educational programming, and there's already not enough on television right now for kids.
Can you talk about the current rules around how much children's programming has to be offered? And just a point here, when people say, why should the government intervene if a private company is providing programming, the whole idea of what's unique about the private companies that are engaged in broadcasting the public airwaves?
Yes, absolutely. Well, right now, under FCC guidelines, commercial broadcasters have to air 3 hours a week of educational programming for kids. And most broadcast stations do that. They provide the bare minimum. And the history of children's television shows that unless they are regulated, commercial broadcasters don't act in the public interest. And why we're so concerned about this is that commercial broadcasters get the airwaves for free. And in return for the airwaves, they have a public interest obligation. Both Congress and the FCC have affirmed that children are a special audience and they merit special consideration. But yet our study shows big media conglomerates are not acting in the best interests of kids. A lot of people will say, oh, well, kids have cable. There's so much more diversity for kids. It doesn't matter what commercial broadcasters do. Well, in fact, our study found that there's actually less diversity today than there was 5 years ago because most children's series on stations owned by large media conglomerates like Disney and Viacom are also aired on cable. So there's actually a decline in the diversity of programming for kids. But the bottom line is that broadcasters do have a public interest obligation to kids. They do get the airwaves for free, and they're not meeting that obligation.
What has the FCC looked at this point? What has Michael Powell, who's chair of the FCC, son of Colin Powell, Secretary of State, how has he evaluated children's programming?
Well, we met with Chairman Powell in January and told him our concerns about kids' programming, and he actually thinks that because of cable, there is a diversity of programming for kids. What's really troubling to us is when the FCC announced in January they were going to change media ownership rules, their notice of proposed rulemaking basically did not mention kids at all. And what was shocking to us is that, you know, kids are a special audience. Both the FCC and Congress have said so. You know, they warrant special protection, no mention of kids whatsoever. And the 12 FCC commissioned studies on media ownership did not mention kids either. So actually, that's why we decided to do the study. We thought someone needs to determine what is going on for kids programming in this country before the FCC proceeds. Again, I think the findings of this study are very serious and, again, signals what could happen with further concentration of ownership, and we think the FCC needs to step back and not proceed until we can assess the full impact of media consolidation on our nation's kids. This is just the first study, but I think we should be looking at other issues like the quality of kids' programming, the number of producers who are providing programs for kids, because we're concerned that that's declining dramatically as well. So the FCC needs to take a step back, slow down, and not do anything until they've assessed the impact of this proposed rule change on children, and they need to fulfill their role as the guardian of the public interest.
What do you think people need to do right now?
I think it's very important for people now to write letters. They can go to our website, childrennow.org, and send a letter to the FCC. They can send a letter to their congressperson, and they also can send a letter to the broadcast networks who have not really covered this issue, even though it has such a profound impact on, you know, the future of democracy and viewpoint diversity in this country. So we encourage people to send letters and tell the FCC and tell their congressperson what they think about this issue and how important they think this issue is for kids and for the rest of the country.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us again. Your website?
Our website is
Your website? Childrennow.org. O-R-G, or just put children now into your search engine. I want to thank you very much for being with us and for talking about media consolidation and children's programming. Patty Miller, director of the Children and Media Program for Children Now. And that does it for the show. If you want to get a video or audio copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is www.democracynow.org. And you can email us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Shroof Abdul-Qudus, Anag Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from No Arrival, Vilkut Suris. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, with help from Rich Kim. Also, special thanks to Uri Galed, Angela Alston, Emily Kunstler, Orlando Richards, Simba Russo, Rafael De La Uz, Gabriel Weiss, Johnny Sender, Karen Renucci, Fatima Mujadidi, Dennis Moynihan, and Jenny Filippazzo. Again, our website, www.democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening and watching.
Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be. Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby are night. Oh, mercy, mercy.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, for the first time, a film that has sent shockwaves around the world will be broadcast in the United States. We are premiering it here on Democracy Now! It's called Afghan Massacre, The Convoy of Death. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today we dispense with the usual headlines to bring you the U.S. broadcast premiere of a documentary film called Afghan Massacre, The Convoy of Death. The film provides eyewitness testimony that U.S. troops were complicit in the massacre of thousands of Taliban prisoners during the Afghan War. It tells the story of thousands of prisoners who surrendered to the U.S. military's Afghan allies after the siege of Kunduz. According to eyewitnesses, some 3,000 of the prisoners were forced into sealed containers and loaded onto trucks for transport to Shebregan prison. Eyewitnesses say when the prisoners began shouting for air, U.S. allied Afghan soldiers fired directly into the truck, killing many of them. The rest suffered through an appalling road trip lasting up to 4 days, clawing at the skin of their fellow prisoners as they licked perspiration and even drank blood from open wounds. Witnesses say that when the trucks arrived and soldiers opened the containers, most of the people inside were dead. They also say U.S. Special Forces redirected the containers carrying the living and dead into the desert and stood by as survivors were shot and buried. Now up to 3,000 bodies lie buried in a mass grave. The film has sent shockwaves around the world. It's been broadcast on national television in Britain, Germany, Italy, and Australia. It's been screened by the European Parliament. It has outraged human rights groups and international human rights lawyers. They're calling for an investigation into whether U.S. Special Forces are guilty of war crimes. But most Americans have never heard of the film. That's because not one corporate media outlet in the United States will touch it. It's never before been broadcast in this country. Well, right now, Democracy Now! Will bring you the film's U.S. broadcast premiere. Afghan Massacre is produced and directed by award-winning Irish filmmaker Jamie Duran. Duran has worked at the highest levels of television film production for more than 20 years. His films have been broadcast on virtually every major channel throughout the world. On average, each of his films are seen in around 35 countries. Before establishing his independent television company, Jamie Duran spent over 7 years at BBC Television. The film is researched by award-winning journalist Najibullah Qureshi, who was beaten almost to death when he tried to obtain video evidence of U.S. Special Forces' complicity in the massacre in Afghanistan. Two of the witnesses who testified in the film are now dead. Today we bring you Afghan Massacre, The Convoy of Death.
After the bloodiest battle of the entire Afghan war, 8,000 Taliban soldiers surrendered to the Northern Alliance and U.S. Special Forces under guarantee that their lives would be spared. Today, up to 3,000 of those men lie in an unmarked desert grave, and American soldiers stand accused by numerous eyewitnesses of being involved in their disappearance.
I think the scale of it, if you talk about thousands of bodies and a cover-up of those bodies, is comparable to thousands of bodies in New York. Now, that is very striking to me, and that's why I think this one will not go away.
Afghan Massacre, The Convoy of Death.
I counted them one by one and handed over 8,000 prisoners. But where are the rest of them? Only 3,015 are left.
Another eyewitness.
I hit the container with bullets to make holes for ventilation. Some of them were killed.
The faces and voices of witnesses to the massacre have been disguised.
I noticed that blood was running from the containers. I saw this horrific scene.
Another eyewitness.
Containers? Oh no, it's not good to mention them.
None of the eyewitnesses appearing in this film have received any payment for their cooperation.
150 to 160 people were dead in each container. The Americans ordered the Shirvagan people to get rid of them before satellite pictures could be taken.
If there are credible allegations from a good number of sources, an investigation should take place.
Yes, absolutely, and I believe that would be the policy of the government of the United States and the military services involved.
Pentagon advisor Richard Perle. All witnesses have agreed to appear at any future international inquiry to provide evidence.
We brought all the prisoners from Shirvagan here to Dasht Lail. All the sick and injured were transferred to my truck. And we brought them to this area we are in now. They took them to different sections, and then they shot them.
Post the 11th of September, the cry has been for truth and justice, and for perpetrators of international crimes to be tracked down and to be prosecuted. And you can't have a double standard where you're saying we'll go to another country and track them down, imprison them, and if they're found guilty, we'll execute them in our courts. But on the other hand, if our boys are involved in it, then they can walk free and go back and live with their neighbours and their families, and in fact, we'll give them total immunity.
During the course of making the film, the producers have been threatened and intimidated. The film's researcher was savagely beaten attempting to obtain video evidence of Afghan soldiers.
What had you seen on the film by then? Early excerpts from this film were shown to the European Parliament. We had received a warning from Afghanistan that the bodies of the murdered prisoners and thus the evidence might be removed. Following pressure from Brussels, the United Nations agreed to monitor the mass graves of Dasht-e Laili. In the middle of June, when we first revealed a small part of our story about the mass graves here at Dasht-e Laili, the Pentagon effectively denied that the atrocity had taken place at all. They also denied that American soldiers were anywhere near the vicinity, nor did any American personnel have any knowledge whatsoever of such a thing taking place. We can now reveal that the Pentagon was lying.
Human rights lawyer Andrew McEntee was heavily involved in the establishment of the International Criminal Court and the man responsible for much of the investigation into the disappeared under General Pinochet's rule in Chile.
The Department of Defense, at least the Pentagon, must say what the role was of the Special Forces. It must, for example, say whether or not they had effective command and control over the Afghanis.
Everything was under the control of the American commander. 200 or 300 bodies were put in each container. Then they took them to their final destination and buried them.
The Pentagon has refused many requests over a long period of time to be interviewed for this film. But a spokesman for the State Department has made it clear his government would prefer the focus of any inquiry to be on the actions of Afghan soldiers rather than their own.
We are looking into the circumstances surrounding the events that are reported in recent press coverage.
Philip Reeker.
As well as other allegations of human rights abuses and war crimes through our embassy in Kabul. We've stressed and continue to stress to Afghan authorities the importance of investigating allegations of human rights violations and war crimes.
Our story begins in November 2001 in a mountain pass close to the town of Kunduz in northern Afghanistan. Taliban soldiers have come to give themselves up under assurances they will not be harmed. These are the first pictures of their surrender. Within days, over 4,000 will be missing, most of them dead. They were murdered by America's closest Afghan allies. But what was the role of U.S. soldiers themselves in this massacre? Mazar region in northwestern Afghanistan, scene of the most crucial battles of the entire war. Take Mazar, and Kabul will be next.
Robert Fox of the International Institute for Strategic Studies.
Why Mazar? The question has existed for 2,000 or even 3,000 years. It's what's called strategic ground. It's where you have to hold this area if you want to get further south, but it also controls the routes east-west. It controls the entry into the whole of the Asian steppe. The Allies, if they knew that they were going to get into Kabul, if they were going to get the Taliban out, they must have and hold Mazar-e-Sharif, and they must have the people who control Mazar-e-Sharif on their side.
The film shows bodies everywhere, buildings destroyed.
The last battle for Mazar-e-Sharif was here at the Sultan Wazir School in the center. 600 Taliban, cut off from those retreating to Kunduz, made a final stand.
They wouldn't surrender, and they even killed the people we sent to negotiate with them. Our soldiers had only one choice, to fight them.
The two major victors in the northwest of the country were rival warlords Mohammad Atta and this man, General Rashid Dostum, widely recognized as the country's most ruthless commander and the man with whom America established its closest links during the war.
They believed, certainly, that Dostum, in the very squeezed timetable that they had after 9/11, could deliver for them, and he was the only one that could deliver and hold Mazar-e-Sharif. I think at that point they had realized there simply wasn't an option in trading him down, in going for a rival, because it would have exposed the rather thin American forces there to great danger as well.
Robert Fox,
now Richard Pearl. In a situation like that, you have to balance out competing interests. Obviously, we would much rather be aligned with Mother Teresa. That wasn't possible in those circumstances. It does lead to a responsibility on our part for trying to help reshape Afghanistan along more humane and democratic lines, and I think that's exactly what we should be doing.
This road goes all the way north to Jalalabad. As Dostum conducted his battle plans, U.S. Special Forces soldiers were constantly by his side.
He's an extremely violent man with an extremely violent record and with a very personal approach to the meeting out of justice and extracting evidence under torture.
You know, when people have friends, they also have enemies. When someone gets well known, some people will say good things and some will say bad things. If you think I'm a bad person, a hard person, then you don't see me as the people around me see me.
Dostum was the key Northern Alliance figure at the surrender of Kunduz. One of the chief negotiators on the Taliban side was local commander Amir Jan.
A meeting was arranged in Kalai Jangi with General Dostum, Makak, and Atta. The Americans were there, along with a few Englishmen. At the meeting, they took a decision that the Afghans accept Mullah Omar. Would be free to go home if they gave up their weapons. And the Al-Qaeda and foreign fighters would hand themselves over under the protection of the United Nations.
But before the final agreement had been signed, 470 mainly foreign Taliban soldiers broke off from the main group surrendering at Kunduz and arrived without warning at Mazar. They claimed to have come to give themselves up, but the Northern Alliance commandos and their American allies were suspicious, fearing an attempted fight back by the enemy. Kalai Jangi, a giant mud brick fort on the outskirts of Mazar, which Dostum made his military headquarters after capturing the city. A section of the main building was made available to American Special Forces and CIA personnel who had arrived to interrogate the prisoners.
These men are dead. These men are dead.
The Taliban were housed in this block before being taken out one by one and made to sit in long lines across the fort interior, their arms tied behind their backs. Chechens, Arabs, Pakistanis, and Uzbeks. Only a few were Afghans. Amongst the prisoners was John Walker Lind, the American Taliban, who attempted to conceal his identity from two CIA officers.
You are listening to Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death, produced by Jamie Duran, first U.S. premiere here on Democracy Now! Coming up next, you'll hear CIA agent Mike Spam interrogating American Taliban prisoner John Walker Lind, shortly before Spam was killed in the famous prison uprising of Mazar-e Sharif. That's here on Democracy Now! Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to the U.S. broadcast premiere of Afghan Massacre, The Convoy of Death, here on Democracy Now!, we turn now to footage that may never have been broadcast before in the United States. You'll hear CIA officer Mike Spam interrogating American Taliban prisoner John Walker Lind shortly before Spam was killed in the famous prison uprising. Listen closely. It's hard to hear. Lind is kneeling on the ground with his arms tied behind his back. Two CIA officers are standing right in front of him. The CIA agents say to each other, The problem is he needs to decide if he wants to live or die. I mean, if he don't want to die here, he's going to die here because we're just going to leave him and he's going to stay in prison for the rest of his life. Short life. It's his decision. We can only help those guys who want to talk to us. We return to Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death.
Obviously, it is. But the problem is he needs to decide if he wants to live or die and die here. I mean, if you don't want to die here, he's going to die here, because this is where we're just going to leave, and they're going to put him in prison the rest of his fucking life. You know, short life. It's his decision, man. We can only help those guys who want to talk to us. We can only get the Red Cross to help so many guys. If they don't talk to us, we can't. We can't.
Just an hour or so after these pictures were taken, one of them, Mike Spann, would be dead, following an uprising amongst the prisoners.
Simon Brooks, International
Red
Cross.
Some shots, some automatic rifle fire coming from this direction over here. Now, I mean, again, you yourself will know in Afghanistan, I mean, automatic rifle fire of a limited nature is not a particularly surprising thing. However, what happened was this continued, and then there was also some loud explosions.
A Northern Alliance soldier says,
at one point, two of them broke out. They grabbed a weapon from a guard and killed one of our soldiers. Then they grabbed grenades and threw them, killing many more. We're going to hit them hard. We won't let them survive. They are surrounded by us. There's only one way left for them. Fight or be killed.
The chopper that's coming in wants to land south.
Up to this point, the British had denied that their special forces were operating inside Afghanistan. But the SAS and SBS can clearly be seen leading the attack while US Air Force personnel call in plane strikes. Researcher Najibullah Qureshi had taken these extraordinary pictures at the height of the battle.
They came up here on many occasions for a firefight, and the last time I was here was at dusk, and they had another fight and left. No one seemed bothered. Just one American soldier asked me where I was from, and I replied that I am just an Afghan journalist.
Later that same evening, Qureshi almost lost his own life during a Taliban mortar attack.
I wanted to go to one of the gates to interview some soldiers. On one side were the Taliban, on the other, our forces. A mortar round hit the Northern Alliance headquarters, and then another one struck 10 or 20 meters from us. 17 of us were blown up, and only three of us survived with injuries.
By the morning of the third day of fighting, every Taliban on the surface of the fort had been killed. Many still with their arms tied behind their backs.
I mean, you can see it's an extremely large area here. In fact, it's deceptively large when you're outside. They were spread all around. I mean, you can see behind us over here are the stables. There were many bodies actually inside. They appear to be taking refuge of some description, piled together. You can see small copses here, trees. People obviously I think really thinking that maybe if they could hide themselves in there, I mean, it really was extremely disturbing to see the extent of the bodies and the way that they were spread out, and really some of the horrific ways that they must have died in. I mean, the expressions on some of the faces were really, you know, as I say, they were disturbing, I think, for everybody who was associated with that exercise.
That was Red Cross's Simon Brooks.
But what no one knew at the time was that 86 Taliban soldiers had survived in the tunnels below the fort, including John Walker Lind. When they finally surrendered, he and the others were questioned by Afghan soldiers prior to being handed over to the Americans.
My father's name.
Father, no.
Republic.
Huh?
Republic.
Republic.
Oh.
Are you Republic?
Oh.
America.
America? America?
Yeah.
Where are you from? Hey, where are you from?
Washington, D.C.
Huh? Washington, D.C.?
General Dostum arrived to reassure the prisoners. In front of the television cameras, he told them they would receive the best treatment available.
Don't be scared. No one is going to kill you. We're going to give you to the UN. They can do what they like with you. Tell them that. Are there any wounded?
Dostum puts that question to one of the Taliban, who answers yes. Dostum then responds.
Take them to the hospital immediately.
As for Lind, after interrogation by U.S. personnel, he was transferred to Cuba. Dostum began a mopping up operation, touring local villages demanding that they hand over their weapons and any Taliban they might be hiding.
If you upset me, I'm telling you. No one except God up there and me down here will care about you. You will lose your honor. This is very serious.
General Dostum.
Your village might be looted. Your family will be in danger. They'll be killed. They'll be raped. There will be no safety for them. I'm telling you straight. You must be honest with me. I'm being honest with you here.
By this time, most of the international press corps had packed up and gone home. The capture of the American Taliban had been the big story. The fate of the other 7,000-odd prisoners who'd surrendered at Kunduz was not front-page news. Just a few miles away from Kalajangi lies another huge fortress, its name Kalajzaini. The remaining Taliban were taken here before being sent on to a prison further west. But according to official figures, only 3,000 actually made it to that prison alive. And the man who negotiated the surrender claims that many of these are not even amongst the original group he handed over.
Only 3,015 are left, and amongst these 3,015 are local people who were taken just for speaking Pashto. They also took local Pashtun from Balkh, Shebergan, Mamuna, Faryab, and Sarapul. They counted them as Al-Qaeda too. These were not even part of the original 8,000.
In an attempt to explain the missing prisoners, Dostum recently claimed that only between 3 and 4,000 gave themselves up at Kunduz. He was clearly unaware that his own general, in command at Kalajzaini at the time, had already been interviewed by us.
General Abdul Rahmatullah, Northern Alliance.
When the prisoners were captured in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz, they came here to Kalajzaini. About 7,000 of them came here and we took control of them.
So what happened to the missing thousands? It's known that some hundreds were sold to the security services of their respective countries by the warlords, an Afghan tradition. Uzbeks to the feared SNB, and Chechens to the KGB in Russia. Their fate can only be guessed at. The first few thousand to arrive at Kalyazhny were the lucky ones. After final checks to ensure they had no weapons, they were allowed to continue their journey by truck to Sheberhan prison, some 120 kilometers to the west. The jail, built to accommodate just 600 at most, was bursting at the seams.
Tell me about physically moving the prisoners from here to Sheberhan. That must have been very difficult.
General Dromatello of the Northern Alliance.
We used trucks to transport them. They were surrounded by soldiers. There weren't any buses, so we used lorries for their transportation.
At this point, our researcher interrupts.
What about the containers?
Containers? Oh no, it's not good to mention them.
It's between you and me.
We put some of the prisoners in containers, but we had already made some holes for ventilation. We transported them by container to ensure we didn't lose any of them.
In fact, as the last group sat in swathes across Kalyazhny, rumors of the revolt at Kalyazhny reached Dostum's soldiers. The Taliban had killed many of their comrades, and now revenge was in the air.
General Dostum.
A group of Taliban from Kunduz, Balkh and Chimatil were, as those inside Kalyazhny had planned to take Mazar. Now their plans are smashed. But let me tell you, it was at a high cost. I had 205 injured and 45 killed.
Now there would be little sympathy for the 3,000 Taliban prisoners yet to be transported to the jail at Sheberhan. In a coordinated operation, truck drivers from all over the region had their vehicles commandeered by armed soldiers. Containers were loaded onto the back of the flatbeds, and the drivers compelled to take their vehicles to Kalyazhny.
We were coming in from Mazar when they seized our trucks for free and took us to Kalyazhny, where there were already a lot of trucks. At about 2 a.m., they loaded our trucks with the prisoners. We were to the north of Kalyazhny, where we loaded the trucks.
Originally loaded onto trucks at Kunduz, many of these men were crammed 200 to 300 at a time into the backs of sealed containers. After around 20 minutes, the prisoners began crying out for air.
The weather was very hot. They put too many people inside the containers. Many died because there was no air.
Another eyewitness has asked how many containers were at Kalyazhny when he left.
There were about 25 containers. The condition of them was very bad because the prisoners couldn't breathe. So they shot into the containers and some of them were killed.
Another eyewitness.
They told us to stop the trucks and we came down. After that, they shot into the containers. Blood came pouring out of the containers. They were screaming
inside.
One Afghan
soldier admits that he personally murdered prisoners.
I hit the containers with bullets to make holes for ventilation, and some of them were killed.
You specifically shot holes into the containers. Who gave you those orders?
My commanders ordered me to hit the containers for ventilation, and because of that, some prisoners died.
But this was no humanitarian gesture. Rather than shooting into the roofs of the containers, the soldiers fired at random, killing those nearest the walls. A local taxi driver had called in at a petrol station on the road to Shibarhan.
I smelled something strange and asked the attendant where the smell was coming from. He said, "Look behind you." There were three trucks with containers fixed on them. Blood was running from the containers. My hair stood on end. It was horrific.
Whether or not the prisoners in the containers were ever really destined to reach Shibarhan must be open to question. The jail was full, and those already incarcerated were facing hardships of a different kind at the hands of American soldiers. They were reluctant to talk, particularly when the prison chiefs hovered close by, listening to our conversation. But one Taliban, who had been filmed during the surrender, was more forthcoming when we interviewed him out of earshot of the prison guards.
They were searching for bin Laden and questioning us about Al-Qaeda. They were cruel. They took some of our men to Cuba. And they did a lot of things in here which scared us. The American commandos beat many of us to scare us into talking.
One of the Afghan officers, present at the time, confirms his story.
They cut their hair and beards, mainly the Arab prisoners. Sometimes they chose one for pleasure, took the prisoner outside, beat them, and then returned them to the prison. But sometimes they were never returned, and they disappeared. The prisoner disappeared. I was a witness. They came after 2 or 3 days. They broke some prisoners' necks and were beating others. They were crying, but everyone ignored them.
These things you saw specifically yourself?
Yes.
But for those prisoners crammed inside the containers, a quick death would have come as a blessing. Some of them remained for days in the desert before reaching Shibarhan. Accounts from survivors talk of licking the sweat off each other's bodies and even biting their fellow captives in a desperate effort to gain fluid in any form. The Pentagon has stated frequently that it knew nothing of the container convoy.
The Americans were in charge.
The interviewer asks, where were they, on the walls or near the gates of the fort?
They were standing at the front gates, where the prisoners were. When we got to the Shibarhan prison, there were some Americans and some Afghan soldiers. They wanted to unload the trucks, and they were taking charge of the area.
How many American soldiers were there?
About 150 to 160. We didn't count the number.
What were the Americans doing in the prison?
They were there to make sure the prison was secure. There were so many Americans, and they were all armed and wearing their uniforms.
As the containers were opened, the full extent of the carnage became apparent. One soldier, who has since fled from Afghanistan, describes the scene in an interview with a Pakistani newspaper.
I shall never forget the sensation as long as I live. It was the most revolting and most powerful stench you could ever imagine. A mixture of feces, urine, blood, vomit, and rotting flesh. It was a smell to make you forget all other smells you ever experienced in your life.
For 10 days, the Red Cross tried to get access, but were refused. They were told that they couldn't enter because American soldiers were working inside. And this picture, taken at Shebahan on December 1st, 2001, during the period when the containers were arriving at the prison, confirms their presence. Witnesses speak of US soldiers searching the dead for identification before insisting that the Afghans remove the bodies from the prison. The Pentagon, however, will not comment.
It was particularly important to find any identification on these bodies because they were desperate for intelligence on Al-Qaeda. They had underestimated the strength of Al-Qaeda and its spread. They knew very little about it. So human sensibilities did go out of the window.
That was Robert
The healthy Fox. Captives were led into the prison and the dead packed into single containers. But many of the prisoners had not died. Some were so badly wounded, they were thrown back into the containers with the dead. Others were simply unconscious following the journey to Shebahan. Using a small tourist camera to avoid detection, we travelled to the desert of Dasht-e-Laili, just 10 minutes from the prison, with two drivers who agreed to show us where they were ordered to take the containers.
Some of the Taliban were injured, and others were so weak they were unconscious. We brought them to this place, which is called Dasht Layl, and they were shot there, there and over there.
Another eyewitness.
They took my truck and loaded a container to Sherbagan and after that to Dasht Layli, where they were shot by the soldiers. I made four trips backwards and forwards with the prisoners.
The mounds of sand show clearly where many of the bodies lie. Human bones and a few pieces of clothing with Pakistani labels are all that remain of those buried near the top of the piles.
How many people were you carrying?
About 140 to 150 each time.
Did you bring them here?
Yes.
What was done with these people?
They were brought here and shot.
They were alive?
Some of them were alive. Some of these were injured and the rest were unconscious.
When you brought the prisoners here, were they with you?
Yes, they were.
Here at this spot?
Yes, here.
How many American soldiers were with you?
Lots of them, maybe 30 to 40. They came with us the first two times, but I didn't see them on the last two trips.
If American soldiers were involved in covering up their role at Shebahan prison, it would border on war crimes. If they stood by as the summary execution of prisoners took place when they could have intervened, this would be positively criminal. But could the United States argue they were not in a responsible position?
They would not have taken orders from Afghans. They would have been in charge of security there, therefore it is an American command, therefore it is ultimately an American responsibility for whatever went on under the eyes of those American soldiers.
That was analyst Robert Fox.
It's quite clear that because you have film evidence of a mass grave, people confessing that the relevant authorities, be they American, Afghani, or international, must carry out an investigation. You have identified the site of a mass grave. You've identified bodies in those graves, and it's quite clear again that pathologists, forensic pathologists, exhuming the bodies, could identify the cause of death, and I think very importantly, could identify who these people are, because their families had a right to know. They have been disappeared involuntarily after being murdered.
Lawyer Andrew McEntee.
Late September 2002. Just over a year after the murder of over 3,000 Americans by Al-Qaeda, human rights expert Andrew McEntee arrives at the scene of another massacre this time said to involve U.S. special forces.
But I understand from very good sources in international organizations, together with the witnesses, that we're certainly talking at 2,000 upwards here, 2,000 to 2,500 in this area.
Is this from a reliable source, an official source?
Yes, I'm not at liberty to say who, but I can tell you so it's a very reliable source, which has not yet gone public.
The grave covers an area well in excess of 1,000 square meters.
Everything I've seen here is consistent with testimonies I've heard and read. There seems to be a large area where there's at least... There are several pits here which clearly have bodies in them, clothing. Bullets are consistent with shootings beside the graves. And there are bullets all over the place, cases of bullets. And somebody's been a bit clumsy in removing the evidence. The Americans couldn't have been kept out of the fact there was a major industrial operation with the excavation going on here and containers coming in, the area closed off for a couple of days. They couldn't have been kept out of that. Having effective command and control does mean they were senior in the chain of command. With knowledge, or presuming they had knowledge of what was going on, yes, they had a responsibility to stop it.
General Dostum has said recently that he would agree to an international investigation. But there's a small problem. He says he can't guarantee the safety of those involved.
We have recently spoken with the local leaders regarding this investigation.
Manuel Gigante, United Nations Council.
They had made statements that they were prepared to cooperate with an investigation. And what we raised with them is, how about, for instance, security? Both for the investigators, but above all for witnesses. And they say that they cannot provide 100% security.
Every one of our witnesses has risked their lives by taking part in this film. These, and many others too frightened to be interviewed, are willing to appear at any future international inquiry if their safety is guaranteed. Surely you should be considering as a priority a witness protection scheme now.
Which you can only do with many other actors. You don't do alone. You said you have been to this country several times. You probably know the risks for those who are here. Therefore, you know it's not a simple endeavor.
Security in northern Afghanistan is a virtually impossible concept to grasp, particularly when you're investigating the very people who hold all the cards. Our local researcher, Najibullah Qureshi, had managed to access damning footage of events at Kali Zaini, Shibar Khan, and Dashti Laili. He had been shown a tape of 1.5 hours in length, which included film of Dostum's soldiers shooting into the containers, American personnel surrounding those same containers as the bodies were dragged off at Shibar Khan, and crucially, pictures of the summary executions at Dashti Laili, with US special forces standing by, doing nothing to intervene. A price was agreed, and Najibullah left Mazar for the handover. We could only wait. As the day wore on, we became concerned.
I had taken a VCR with me to copy the film. I rewound it to the beginning and started making the copy. I only managed to record 1.5 minutes during the time on the film when they were loading the Taliban onto the containers. They were opening and loading them onto containers, and then they started shooting into the containers. Just then, a fat man entered the room. There were 3 people, one of whom was armed. The person who was giving me the film told me, quote, "This is my brother." His brother swore at him and said he told him not to give the film to anyone. Quote, "Why have you given him the film?" he asked. Then they started beating us. They hit my head a lot at the beginning. After that, I fell unconscious.
Drifting in and out of consciousness, he remembers being driven in a car, his captors apparently planning to dispose of his body.
One of them was saying, quote, "There's a well around here." They stopped the car and took me out. Then another car arrived, but they started beating me again. After that, I don't know what happened. I woke up and I was home.
Although nothing can be certain, it appears that the people in the other car knew Najibullah and managed to save his life, despite his captors giving him a final beating.
There was some very interesting and dangerous footage on the film.
Could this film be General Dostum's insurance policy? Could he be saying, if I get accused of war crimes, then I'll bring down the Americans with me?
What evidence did you see in the film of American involvement?
I saw lots of them at Sherbaghan prison. We can see it on the footage, Americans at Sherbaghan prison. You can see them standing by when they open the containers. There's a lot of footage of them. You can also see a few of them at Dasht Laili.
For 8 days, Najibullah remained under armed guards we provided at a safe house far from Mazar until he was ready to travel.
The winner of the 2002 Rory Peck Award for Hard News is Najibullah Kiroshan.
And after recuperation in London lasting over a month, his bravery was recognised with a major award for work contained in this film.
I wish a safe and prosperous life for all the journalists in the world, without interference in their profession, and also I would like to dedicate this award to the people of Afghanistan, my lovely country.
But without an independent inquiry into the events in northern Afghanistan, that bravery will have been wasted. The United Nations fears for the safety of its own staff, and the United States will not allow its military personnel to be tried for alleged war crimes abroad. While the Pentagon refused to be interviewed for this program, we did manage to extract some information. In June, Colonel Rick Thomas of Central Command told us they had held an internal inquiry and that they were satisfied that no American personnel had taken part in nor observed any atrocity at Sheberhan or Dasht-e-Laili. But in recent days, Colonel Thomas told us there was no inquiry after all. Merely a short debriefing of soldiers as they arrived home.
NATO armies have boards of inquiries, and I would be astonished that nothing has happened in the United States about this. It must be looked into.
Robert Fox.
In Kabul, at least, there's a glint of light suggesting that the fledgling administration there is willing to follow a path where the US authorities may fear to tread.
What would the Afghan government's reaction be if these crimes were proved against the forces of General Dostum? What would your government's reaction be?
If and investigators find that there is crime, Afghan government exactly follow that in court.
In the courts?
Sir, you're sure? 100%.
You would take General Dostum to court?
Sure.
That was Afghan's Information Minister Taj Mohammad Wardak.
...to try its most dangerous warlord in the courts, their chances of success are virtually nil. The Kabul administration has no real influence outside the capital and would need the support of Dostum's greatest ally, America, to launch an investigation. The US authorities, for their part, are desperate to avoid such a scenario, as it would almost certainly result in their own soldiers facing charges of war crimes. One source, inside the Pentagon, told us, "You have to understand, there are folk in here who would rather this story just went away." But pressure is beginning to grow in Washington.
These are prisoners who gave themselves up,
right,
were disarmed,
right,
and then shipped out to the desert and murdered.
Yes, no, that would be obviously a very serious concern and not something that we would approve.
This is Richard Pearl.
Would it concern you that American soldiers were standing by watching as they were murdered?
Yes, it would.
Would you believe those were grounds for a major investigation?
Absolutely.
You would like to see that investigation?
Absolutely. If there is credible evidence that Americans were present when prisoners were being executed, that certainly ought to be investigated.
The American command has what is known as the stovepipe in operations. That means war. It goes from top to bottom and bottom to top. So even the Pentagon would have known very, very quickly.
A crime is a crime under American criminal law. There is prima facie evidence. It's building, it's growing. And I think the force of this must lead to the Pentagon, if it's got any sense, coming out with an open inquiry and a proper investigation, including asking itself, has there been a cover-up in the Pentagon as well as in Afghanistan?
Two of the eyewitnesses who appeared in the film have been killed. Others, including many not involved with the program, are currently being arrested, detained, and tortured. Efforts continue to secure the safety of all remaining witnesses to the massacre in northern Afghanistan. This film, Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death, was produced by Jamie Duran. It was researched by the Afghan award-winning journalist Najibullah Qureshi, who almost died as he tried to obtain the footage for this film. This concludes the U.S. broadcast premiere of Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death. You can go to our website for more information, www.democracynow.org. You can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Sharif Abdel Kadous. Also special thanks to Mike DeFilippo, happy birthday Mike, and Rich Kim, and Vilka Tsouras. We also want to bid a very fond farewell to Fatima Mojadidi. Today is her last day with us at Democracy Now! Her persistence, intelligence, sensitivity, her diligence, and her friendliness and wonderful managing skills have contributed tremendously to Democracy Now! Over this last year. Thank you. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening and watching.